The Digital Identity Wars, Who Controls Your Data by 2030. This is a huge, huge topic. We all know who's winning that race in China. In the UK, it looks like the government is winning it, despite the fact that we've had 3 million people not want a digital ID. It's quite worrying, really, isn't it? The situation that we're in because of, you know, George Orwell's 1984, the control of the masses. Data is the new oil, right? So what's your view? I know you've been pondering this for decades.
It's a biggie. We have been in a data world, if you will, the big data world since the 80s. I need to start with a startling statistic, and then I'll go back. Today is October 29, 2025. Which is unremarkable, other than in the United States, you have to be a baseball fan, you know, the World Series. Other than there's nothing historically relevant to date, except that yesterday, October 28th, and again, it will happen today, October 29th, there's more data that has been developed and added to the body of data in the world yesterday, for the one day, than the entire aggregate in history. Okay, now, so again, I don't know what the quantifier is, but if we added 10 yesterday, that's more than everything in history before. We'll add 10 more today. Of course, what drives this is three things. AI, the availability of data, and the relative ease with which we crunch the data, assemble it, crunch it, interrogate it, mine it, whatever it is that we do with it. What's in the data? Well, it's a lot of scientific stuff, a lot of historical stuff. And then there's a lot about the most important component in commerce, which is people, the consumer. So the consumer data is exponentially bigger, broader, deeper today than it was yesterday. Because everyone collects everything. You can't go to the local cleaners without them asking, can you mind signing up? Heck, I can't buy a bar of soap from Amazon without coughing up all the stuff about me and us. And of course, I remember back in the old days, a couple of decades ago, when we were confronted with not having enough data that we thought we needed, we got into data by, It was a presumptive data. There are a lot of elegant words for it. In simple terms, I don't know anything about you. I can't find, you're not in a database. But you know what? I can infer a lot about you, called infer data. In other words, we know that if we look at the neighborhood you live in, the block you live in, the building you live in, house you live in, we look at population density and all of that. And then we look at population trends in that area. And then we say, well, we don't know anything about schooler, but the family living directly across the street, we know a lot about them. And statistically, we derive the data saying likelihood that schooler is X age, likelihood is percentage-wise married, not married, children, how old they are, and interests. It's very seldom that you have a neighbor who buys Monets and Picassos and a neighbor who's on social assistance. You know, that's the extreme idea. So the question is, how much data can you get on anyone? Well, our financial database that is focused on credit card data, that's the whole idea. And it's used by people who sell, promote credit cards, debit cards, bank cards, retail cards. Okay, that's just simple enough as a concept, except that we broadened the appeal of this massive database, 120 million households. And one of the ways we do that is we go out and literally buy 500 data points. Think about that. I can think of 10 or 20 because I've been around for so long, but I can't think of 30 or 40 data points that make any sense at all. They don't. Any number of combinations make sense for a marketer. Okay, we need to sell this insurance policy to Marine Corps former service members' widows who have two teenage children. Okay, now there are some data points there that are relevant in terms of developing a psychological profile to create a potential prospect that's your customer. Now, so it's this is scary stuff because you have to be careful not to make judgments on people based on some of the data. We make no credit judgments because we just don't know. I mean, but the data that's out there is spellbindingly scary for data user. I know a bit about database marketing. I know a lot about predictive modeling, developing all these wonderful, great tools that are used everywhere all the time. And it scares the heck out of me because when you get into that level of volume, that level of depth, and I don't want to define that breadth and depth, the potential for abuse is as good as the potential for good use.
Yeah.
Okay. That you can't abuse the data. And there are a lot of people, there are statistics on people who wake up in the morning with nefarious intent. Today, I'm going to do this. And you know, I'll repeat this, and then I want to spend 2 minutes on just a minute on where are the big tipping points about this. I know I shared this with you. I sat on the plane for many hours. It was a terrible flight, delayed by umpteen hours. I sat next to this man, very interesting, nice man. He was the CTO, head tech, for a supermarket chain. Let me explain. A chain in the Midwest, they have seven stores, seven medium-sized stores. We're not talking about the massive conglomerates we have in the States. This is a chain in the Midwest. I think they have seven stores. The stores are somewhere around 75,000 square feet, as opposed to Kroger stores. There are, I know, 100 Kroger stores in L.A. They're all 200,000 square feet. This is small. I could not figure out, after 7 hours of talking to this very smart guy, his number one concern was fighting off 11 attempts weekly to hack their database. Okay, now that is what he does more than anything else. That's what he spends more money. Who wants to know the people go to a store, when do they buy soap, toilet paper, cereal, how often and why? Because the why, you derive the why from the sequence of activity. But there's 11 attempts to hack that. Now, so the question then is, what do they want? Data. And what are they going to do with the data? Well, you know, one of my acquaintances who is a genuine data analyst, it's kind of like the Supreme Court of the United States, stuff like that. Well, just give it to me and I'll figure out what to do with it. You know, so let's just we'll figure out how to abuse it. And then, of course, you and I always regress to the interesting thing, which is the assembly of all the data, which ends up being a digital ID, which if you're not vigilant, as you started this out with very appropriately, the digital ID becomes a social score. A social score is the fastest way to marginalizing people, or if you want to be Orwellian about it, to generating people at a level that you want rather than not want. That's the Chinese model today. You know, and that to me is the scariest thing about data. It will aggregate it. Listen, you and I have digital IDs. I live in the United States. You live in Croatia today. I know I have digital IDs. I have them with a couple of retailers. I have them. And certainly the second biggest aggregator of data in terms of digital IDs is the United States government, Social Security. Right. Somebody needs to enlighten me. The 260 million adults in America. Let me define adults, 18 and over. I pick 18 because pretty much everybody who's 18 in America will get a Social Security card. Of course, there are 540 million of those, somewhere in 540 and 1 billion that have been issued. Mm-hmm. Now, if there are 260 million people with credit Social Security numbers, there are 400 or 500 million credit Social Security numbers out there.
Yeah, I found that really quite. Okay. It's really quite bizarre.
Now, the difference between what we're doing here now, and mind you, You know how long it takes the credit check when you walk into a retailer? I'd like to buy that TV on credit. I want to buy a car, whatever. You know how long the credit check
takes? 5 seconds or something, less.
Exactly. 2 seconds. Exactly. Now, that data is there spinning around. And as long as we don't run out of coal, we can get it. Or uranium. Yeah. We can get the data.
Yeah.
The scariest thing in the world for me, I know you agree, we've talked about it, is the digital ID, if you will, in China. That is the biggest event of this kind in the history of the world. Every single Chinese human has a social score. What's a social score? You buy milk twice a week instead of one. That's a point of interest. You go to movies. That's what kind of movie. Did you have a cup of coffee in the shop? It's as trivial as that. And, of course, if I'm not mistaken, there are 2.8 million cameras in China in the big cities. So in terms of the movement, every single thing you do is a digital piece of digital footprint. The problem is that you accumulate that score. And if the score gets low enough, you're now superfluous.
Exactly right. But then at the moment, you know, who's winning the race to control digital identity, right? And why should business leaders care, right? Like back to the question, business leaders should care because it can improve their revenue. And I mean, I was reading something. I'm just going to put my glasses on and read this to you, which is quite incredible. I had no idea about this, but basically, houses of worship are quietly using data and AI as engines of surveillance and reshaping the theology of trust, which is a bizarre thing. So basically, there's a marketing tool that is basically being used in America by a lot of churches. We're talking hundreds of thousands of churches because it's big business, right? And thousands of churches have been sold on the idea that spiritual health can be managed like customer engagement, which I thought was fascinating. It's the problems exist is when you combine all of this with facial recognition. And according to this article, to the best of my knowledge, no church notifies its congregants that it's using facial recognition. So think about that. You're basically going into a church, right? They're measuring your prayer requests, okay? And they basically have, and how they're looking at it is they can steward their people, right? But there is potential for the information gathered to be used against them in their life outside the church. There's a massive risk for this. But it's also, if you look at the reverse of it, so someone is committed to being part of a religious organization. We're not talking about this from me and you being religious or not religious. We're talking about it from the customer experience, right? And say, for example, they don't go to church 1 week. What you can do is you can, like marketing systems of the last 30 years, you send them an email or 20 years and it says, hey, John, I noticed you weren't in church this week. But also you can change the wording. If you plug all of these things in to language models and you have really substantial data on these people, you can actually help them in their lives, but you can also turn them off. You can also send them over the edge. Because if you send them the wrong communication at the wrong time, like, for example, someone is sending me a podcast request all the time. I get these automated requests. Hey, I want to be on your podcast show, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, and I reply and they don't reply. And then 2 days later, I get another message. It says, hey, I want to be on your podcast show. And I'm like, come on. But I'm not on the edge of killing myself, right? Some of these people could be on the edge. And I do believe that in the future, this can be used as a positive. And actually, if if a priest reaches out at exactly the right time for these individuals, based upon the knowledge that they have, okay, they donate this amount of money usually, they haven't been to church for about 3 weeks. So there are all these trigger points, right? And then the data then is fed into this engine. I actually think that it could be really beneficial. It could actually mean that they could get food. They might not suffer at home so much because they know that, for example, this person is maybe been to hospital. Once you combine hospital data with all these things, but we are not in control of the data that they hold on us. We're in control of, the government is in control of the health data. But are they allowed? If you could say, okay, well, when you go to the health center, you could say, well, I don't want my data being used by other organizations. I don't want my data being used. But then you also have these other pieces of data, which are synthetic data, right? Which then sit over the top of this other data, which then is used to manipulate people into buying stuff. I'm going to say manipulate for want of a better word. But if we get to the point of knowing so much about someone, then we know that actually they buy this thing regularly and they're going to run out of it next week and they might have forgotten, then actually it could be quite useful. Like, for example, my friend buys a printer. They send him printer ink every month. He's told them when it's going to run out. He clicks a button and it. But the moment that you're not in control of the data is when, personally, I believe the problems exist. So my opinion from where I'm sitting is there are levels. If you look at it like a box, right, there's this box of data which you're in control of, right? You're in control of this specific box. But then the more you give away to Facebook, the more you talk on your mobile phone and the microphone is on, the more data that marketers have on you because they are tracking you. If you have not adjusted your phone settings that says, no, I will not allow my mobile phone to track my voice on Facebook, I'm not giving microphone access, then they don't have information to send you a pop-up image of and an advert based upon something you said yesterday or today, right?
Let's go backwards. I know more than a couple lawyers, law firms, that make an exceptional living based upon the failure rate of what you just said, the whole opt-out thing. I don't want to get to, I want to, you know, I'm involved in a situation now with a multi company with a bunch of labels, a bunch of brands, and because they just don't care, the law in 50 states is X. Well, they just flaunt that, because the money they spent defending it is less than the benefit they believe. But I promise you, the pretense of privacy is just that, privacy. And look, I know a great deal about these devices. Forgive me for the modesty of that. And I went through a very interesting exercise. I know the extent to which this device is blocked from the internet. I know that. It's... but for a Faraday box, this ain't communicating with anybody. Explain that way a 22-year-old kid at a Verizon store was able to retrieve my email addresses without the thing uploading in the cloud. Explain that to me. There's only one explanation. But let me go back. There's three things that I would like to comment on that you said. Church. Is it heresy to say that organized religion, in fact, is a business as well?
It is a business. Most definitely.
So I'm not being a heretic, or I'm certainly agnostic, but I'm not being a heretic. One suggests that they need your contributions. That's from the Vatican on down to the parish. In the Catholic world, same with the whole hierarchy of Protestantism, same in Judaism, same in Shinto,
same in all the religions.
So if I can tell a religious organization, I can double the givings for you.
Yep.
They say, sure, I can fix a rectory. I can pay the nuns better. The answer is sure, no problem. Moving on to
How do you balance protecting customer data with driving revenue growth? Because that's a difficult one, isn't it?
Thank you for prefacing that this was a tough question. I have not thought it through, but having gone through a cycle or two when, you know, it's kind of like you have to know not to kill the golden goose. And, you know, a famous line from a famous movie, greed is good. That was a great movie. Michael Douglas, greed is good. But greed is good. Stupid is not good. Greed and stupid is deadly. So yep. to me, and this is counsel I give anybody who wants to listen, clients and otherwise, if you don't understand who your client, who your customer is, and you don't understand your customer needs, wants, desires, fears, go sell shoes in the haberdashery. Now, and don't get the mass markets, because every one of those things you have to understand. You can't fulfill them all, but you have to address them all. Now, just an anecdote, because I'm a storyteller. One of the companies that I was fortunate to grow up in, we fulfill 10, 12, 14 million customer orders a year. We had a customer service department with 360 people. We handled a million contacts a year.
Wow.
Now, that customer service department generated what was called a book, a 36-page report on all the contacts for the week. That was item number 4, understanding weekly agenda for senior staff. Now, if you could not quote the book, you got unemployed. And then we stole something from UPS. They did something very smart. Every senior management person in the company worked customer service one day a month.
Yeah, bye. I like that idea.
You go to that building and you sit down, you get a desk, and you take the calls. You take the calls from people who want to firebomb your house. People thank you for the great product. Where's my order? What happened? My check. What happened to my order? My credit card. You take. If you don't do that, how do you know how you're doing? That's your report card. I think that often C-suite is isolated entirely from customer service. Oh, by the way, the man happened to be the young guy who ran customer service and his staff. Half of their income, because they had a nice salary, and then they got a bonus, which was 100% of the salary. Mm-hmm. Half of the income was dependent entirely on how many complaints they turn into a repeat customer. Now, Then you understand that something you're doing that you believe is perfectly fine, it really isn't. By the time it bubbles to the surface in a big way, it's over. So how do you balance profit and security? In my little world, and I've done this, and I'm just so happy, I had a couple of enlightened clients who thought that was a good idea. Mm-hmm. We did, in fact, go out to an entire customer base in an environment that was competitive. It was always market share discussions, always product reliability, product liability. And once you get to product liability, reliability, all of that, you accumulate a lot of data because you have to know, you know. You have to know. You don't want people blowing themselves up with whatever. And we went out, and this is very laborious. Mm-hmm. We went out and say, listen, we appreciate you, love you. Here are 5 things you'd like to ask you. Be specific, please.
Right.
And those are the 5 things that we worried about going forward. Those are our potentials to tip the scale the wrong way. One side, keep the customer happy, not abuse the privilege of having a customer, and 2, revenue, income and profit. That's your fundamental question. So the question then is, how far do we push this where the cost is too great? Now, it's too cost. Immediate, we solved the problem. We sold them 2 of those when they hated the first one. No, what happens later? because in my world, again, the negative infection rate is much higher than positive. If there's 10 people who say, you should really buy from Manning & Schooler, if Manning & Schooler sends you the wrong size T-shirt, there's 50 people who say, don't buy from them, they sent me the wrong size.
Right.
So it's, you need to understand that. It comes with understanding your customer, understand what it is you're doing and how you're doing it. And, you know, it's very simple. It's like having a family member, friend who is upset with you. And you walk around saying, they're upset with me. They're walking around saying, I'm upset, but they don't know it. Now, how does that make any sense? You're no point walking around being upset at someone without them knowing it. And they don't, you know, how often has it happened in your consulting practice or mine when you have a disgruntled people, disgruntled group, and then when you say, well, why haven't you done it? And they come back, we didn't know we were supposed to. And the we have to manage the expectations of the person whose data we have. We have to understand the pain points. It is laborious to go out to 1,000 people, 5,000 people, say, here are five things we do with your data. And by the way, we can't do what the banks do. They send you the plain number 10 envelope with a little black thing. You don't even know where it's coming from. When you open it up, it's the cheapest piece of paper you've ever seen. In four-point type, 2.5 pages backwards and forwards. I'm not going to read it. I'm fatigued from that. It's the elegant piece of correspondence that says, this is insurance companies, some do that well. Dear Nat, we love you as a customer. We appreciate the business. This is the data we have about you. Is there anything here that you wish we did not have? This is how we use it. Don't make half a page, boom, 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 boom. What you just done is you avoided a tsunami of complaints and you solidified a consumer. So I look at a CEO and say, how much do you know about your consumer? And consumer complaints mean what? 0.1%, 2.5%, $17.2 million. That's what that means to you. No. How many people are complaining about what specifically and why? Now, that's what you need to know as a CEO. And 5 years from now, when we know how often you brush your teeth, because we have statistics on how often you buy toothpaste.
Well, you know what? The thing is that so much data has come out of the bag, right? You know, if you go back about, I'd say about 8 years, maybe, yeah, about 8 years, 9 years. And when this Cambridge Analytica situation happened, lots and lots of people's data was basically taken out of Facebook. So people were given a questionnaire and they had to answer a number of questions. And then the data from, I believe it is 100+ million people, Americans, this data was extracted from Facebook, and it definitely still exists. You can't just data doesn't just disappear, right? Unless someone deletes it, right?
Right.
So someone has taken that data and they've learned how to manipulate people on a mass level, right? But now we have laws. We've got the California law, we've got the GDPR, we've got the EU AI Act. We've got all these regulations that are basically huge, huge minefields for new chief data officers, chief AI officers to navigate, right? And if people aren't navigating those within their businesses, we got really, really big issues. The good news is that there are people that sort of handle that. That is part of a whole other in-depth conversation that really isn't something that I, you know, want to dig into right now. I think I've got an interview somewhere about the GDPR. I think I've also got one perhaps on the AI Act as well. And then there are all sorts of other regulations that people adhere to. So, you know, it's really dependent on the organization. Every organization is responsible for their own data, their own reputation, and how they handle that, right? And you know, and if you want any pointers on that, you need any more information on that kind of stuff, do drop me a message because I can kind of dig that out. But in terms of, I've got one thing that I'd like to just cover before we wrap up. And there are sort of three points that I wanted to cover, but we're not going to get there. I think really, what's the biggest threat to an executive's professional reputation in the digital age is a big question. From my perspective, I think that we're at risk of deep fakes. We're at risk of basically being victimized by people that don't like you. There are all sorts of things that can actually happen in this world now. And unfortunately, some places in the world, they don't have legislation. But actually in Europe, part of the AI Act, it actually restricts that. So if you go and create a deep fake of someone and you actually go and use it, that is actually illegal in the EU, which I think is brilliant. So it's something that is good that's happening in the EU. I think that there are just many, many things that you can do to safeguard your reputation as an executive. But what do you think the biggest sort of risk is for executives, Steve, in this data-led world that we're living in?
Well, I think data theft, it has to be number one, because people are stealing data and not doing that just to have it. They're doing it mm-hmm. to use it or misuse it. Yep. So, you know, there's too many businesses that operate on, well, it's not going to happen to us. We're too good for that. Oh, we're not going to happen. We're too big for that. Well, tell that to the biggest movie studio in the world. Tell that to a lot of government agencies. Imagine hacking a massive U.S. governmental agency and stealing 30 million identities from them. Now, that's pretty brazen stuff, but done and done and done and done. So I think data yeah. theft is yeah, I can't trust you. You know, I remember going through that stuff when Amazon Cloud Services first became a thing. Mm-hmm. And people said, gee, there's cloud service. Are you really going to put your data in there? What if they're hacked? I said, well, the safety is in just the immense volume of it. The only way I worry about being hacked, if I'm targeted, it's not just I just happen to fall in my data along with what? The right. 17 trillion bits a second, you know? There are enough companies that are not investing the necessary money to safeguard the customer data as well as their own, of course. And then talk about a disaster when you have to reach out to your customer and say, sorry, we got hacked.
Yeah, well, I had an email today, Steve. Someone sent me an email and I sent him a message back. I said, no problem. You know, it is what it is. And Microsoft had been hacked, I think. And so he sent me an email saying, all of our customers, our platform's not working and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, hey, no problem. These things happen. Don't worry too much. It'll be over soon. It could be worse, you know.
But
reputation again, isn't it?
It's right, reputation. But what happens as an executive? You are into some product line or whatever vertical you're in, and you have a bunch of customers. And then you're in a competitive environment, market share, competitive environment. And what happens if you send out that email notice saying, dear customer, because you're not smart enough to personalize it, you're too arrogant. Dear customer, we've had a data breach. We're doing everything we can do. But in interest of abundance of caution, be on the lookout for phishing schemes, for people impersonating you, for people trying to steal this. And they list the 4, 5, 6 things that can happen as a result of the data hack. I, for one, moved my business immediately. Why? Because my data is, I can't just do that in 5 seconds. You know, right. ISPs get that because they're in the death zone with competition. And how long does it take me to move my business from the two people that host my stuff to a third one? Nanoseconds. You know, so I love the part. I was sorry. We had a data. How elegant. We had a data breach. And I said, wait a minute. An insurance company. They know my blood type. Okay. But don't worry, we're working on it.
Well, this is an interesting piece. When I was actually reading something the other day about a similar thing to Ancestry.com, right? So basically, because everyone is related to everyone else, basically, so say you've got, but they are, right? Say you've got 280 million people, okay, in America, as an example, roughly 285 or something, maybe.
In America?
Yeah.
360.
Okay, you got 360.
Arguably. We're not
right,
sure.
Arguably, yeah. So imagine this. So say 3 or 4 million people, no, I think it was 6 million, that was it. 6 million people give access to their DNA, okay? The DNA from that database, from those 6 million people, is enough to catch every single criminal in the entire American continent. Think about that, right? No, entire North America, right?
Correct.
So if you commit a crime, just because your stuff, your DNA isn't in the database, they can still catch you based upon the 6 million people who have given their data. I just thought that was fascinating, to be honest. Fascinating.
Well, you know, it's the scary part for me, actually, is that enough people, and that's going, I believe that will change. It'll change sooner than later because people's tolerance to people taking advantage of them is actually shifts with time because we've become accepting. Oh, it happens all the time. Okay. Except the one time that you see it on TV and wait a minute now, honey, do we not have one of those credit cards? We do. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait a minute. Call the bank. Okay. So then all of a sudden the bank who has, I don't know, 214 agents now hire 700 more temps immediately because everyone's calling.
If you value the insights on influential visions, you'll be pleased to know that that is just the public version. Inside Monday Influencer, the indispensable weekly guide to success in business, career, life. You get a weekly email, which also has an audio version narrated personally by us. You get early access to uncut interviews, behind the scenes footage and intel. You get critical insights, unlocking AI and technology for your success. You can download cheat sheets, checklists, and many, many audios which will help you to become a better executive and a business person. Your risk is $1. Join us. The link is in the description. Thank you.